This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 391 for September 1 of 2017. Autonomous Pizza, Hurricane Harvey, and the Nissan POW. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai.
Welcome, everybody, to Out of Line After Hours. I've got Mr. Vasilash here again.
It's the end of the summer edition. Monday will be Labor Day, and back to reality.
I know. I don't want the summer to be over. This is reality. And in fact, we've got a double dose of reality here because we've got Joe White from Reuters, and we've got Chris Pockert from Roadshow by CNET with us.
Thanks for having me.
Great
back.
To have both you guys here.
Good to be here.
We'll be talking about all kinds of things, whatever comes to our mind these days. But the first thing that comes to mind is, what the hell is this car in the studio here, Mr. Pockert?
It's my 1989 Nissan POW. It's a Japanese market mini car, and it's just a little bundle of ridiculous fun.
So why do you have this car, and how did you get this car?
Well, as you know, we're fortunate enough to drive new cars all the time, and they're wonderful. They're safe. They're predictable. Sometimes anodyne. And, you know, I think about tech all day. I want something that's simple at the end of the day sometimes. So I have a Miata. This is sort of in the same vein, the slow car, fast thing. This car has almost no power at all. It's 51 horse when it was new, and I'm sure, you know, a few of them have left the barn. But it's fun to drive. You can't take yourself too seriously driving it. I just really love it.
So did you take little, like, country roads to get to the studio?
No, I took the freeway. Believe it or not, this will do, even with 51 horsepower and a 3-speed automatic, it'll do 80 miles an hour on the freeway as long as it's flat. And yes, absolutely. 0 to 60 it'll get there. It's a usable car. I wanted something like a Citroen Duchevaux or a Renault 4, but this is rarer, cheaper, and more reliable, sits better.
I love these cars. Nissan did a number of other ones, the Escargo, are two others.
The first one was the BE one, which was sort of a semi-ordinary looking hatchback, but it had round headlights, which was sort of new then. Then this car came out. This is the most successful of them. The Nissan Figaro, which was a little canvas back, or canvas roof car, kind of like this, that's more of a sports coupe looking thing. Then the Escargo, which looks like its namesake. It looks like a snail. It's a little delivery van.
What I liked, because in the mid-'80s, Japan, or certainly Nissan and Toyota, got this idea that the market was going to shatter into all kinds of little segments.
Right.
And they wanted to come out with cars that were built to a niche. And they tried to figure out ways of doing them at very low cost. And Toyota had a model called the Sera, whose body panels were all hydroformed, because they figured out they only needed the male part of the die to stamp them with hydroforming. Mm-hmm. And so they cut their tooling cost in half. But the Sera wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't nearly as interesting from a styling standpoint as the POW is.
Well, the Sera's trademark thing was it had the fantastic doors. Those are factory. The POW is interesting to me because it's the original retro car. It predates things like the HHR, the PT Cruiser, the Prowler, all of those things owe on some level some debt of gratitude to the Pike factory cars. And what's interesting about it to me is its construction method. I mean, it's all different kinds of body panels.
Yeah, go through that. Yeah,
so it's got a lot of steel in it, but it also has fiberglass in the front fenders, and the hood is sheet mold compound.
Which is another kind of plastic.
Yeah. And so it's interesting. It's really light. This car only weighs about 1,600 pounds, 1,700 pounds. It's just a neat car. You could get it with or without the canvas roof. You could get it with a manual transmission. Most of them don't have it. This one has a 3-speed automatic. And I've never driven the manual. I hear it's not so great, but I'd still kind of like to have one. But
how'd you find it?
I'd been looking around, for quite a while.
For one of these,
yeah. Mm-hmm. When I finally decided, again, like I was looking at a Duchesneau, that kind of stuff, that this made more sense in a way because it is more drivable. Duchesneau, you can't drive on the freeway. It just isn't powerful enough. My cars tend to only get about 1,000 miles a year because I'm driving press cars all the time. Mm-hmm. And so a car that sits better is better. And a newer Nissan like this being a 1989, but looking a lot older, yet it still delivers that classic driving experience, was a good way to go. So I got it from somebody who had already brought it into the U.S., who was a military doctor that was stationed in Japan, and had brought it to Florida. And I was able to purchase it through Bring a Trailer. But there are other cars in the market here. There's at least 50 or 100 of them.
What's something like this go for?
Well, that's the other nice thing, is they're really inexpensive. You can get one like this for, $5,000 to $7,000. And you will not find a more traffic-stopping $5,000 to $7,000.
No.
Or more of a Grinmobile, honestly, because you're white-knuckling it at pretty low speeds, like a Miata, right? But you're having fun, and I think people assume that you can't take yourself too seriously in a car like this. They want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. They want to know why you're driving on the wrong side of the road. Everybody just assumes you have a decent sense of humor if you can roll around in something that looks like that.
My line was I was driving an Australian Ford Ute one time, and somebody said, why is the steering wheel on the right-hand side? And I said, oh, they made a mistake at the factory. Put it in on the wrong side.
I'm going to use that one because yeah. Normally I just go, oh!
Yeah. Well, there was an issue.
It has a cassette player?
It does. It has a cassette player, and everything in that car, just about, if you look at the interior, is bespoke to this model, not even shared with the other Pike cars. So that's the radio down there.
That radio could fly today.
Yeah.
And that's the one
that's
just in front of the gearshift
knot. That's kind of radio set up there. That's, I like that.
It has an auto seek button where if you push that center button, then the dial swings around and finds the station. But other than things like the vents or the Prindle surround for the gear shift lever, and I'm assuming that those go to other things because they look like they could, pretty much everything in there is a one-off. This all the switch gear, the turn signals, the wheel, none of that fits anything else. And that's an incredible amount of investment for mm-hmm. such a small volume vehicle.
Yeah, there was a whole period around that time when I remember going to the Tokyo Motor Show where the Japanese automakers were kind of indulging this whimsy in that segment. And there was a bunch of cars like that. And then it seemed to kind of all went away. And
well, the bubble burst. Remember, this was pre-bubble Japan.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it was the bubble. And that's all gone now. Oh,
yeah.
Well.
Yeah. The guy that designed this car, Sakao something or other, I forget what his last name is, but he was actually an Olympus designer. He did a lot of cameras and things like that. And then Toyota ended up poaching him for the Will series of cars, which are also sort of retro and have that sort of corrugated quality to the sides and all that, but I don't think visually we're anywhere near as successful and certainly not as commercially successful.
Mm-hmm. Is there any issue in terms of insurance?
I get it through Hagerty. I would imagine if I tried to do it through State Farm, it'd be really hard for people to find in their computers.
Flo is going to go with that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I don't think she's going to find it, but not a plug, but Hagerty was really great. They insure just about anything, and it's agreed value insurance, and you take a couple of snaps, you explain what it is, and it's fine. The harder part is actually registering a car like this. And Michigan, you can register almost anything anyway. And this is legal. Cars that are 25 years or older can be brought in under a single vehicle exemption policy. But there's a lot of paper that goes with it. And when I brought it, it obviously didn't go into the computers there very easily. You can't put the VIN number in.
Right.
And you have to actually have it inspected in state. So I had the local policeman came out and looked it over and filled out a form. And then you bring that form to the Secretary of State's office and you're good to go.
Yeah, but it's interesting. Today, Honda announced the N-Box is going to go on sale in Japan, which appears to be a box-like object, which is not much bigger than that.
Is that a different N-Box? Because they've had an N-Box for a while.
This is the new one, yeah.
The new N-Box.
Cool.
Yeah. When there was the brief flurry of interest in that type of vehicle in this country, very brief.
There's an N-Box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've got one up.
Yeah.
Boy. Yeah, that's a neat car. I mean, in a really weird, very Japanese way.
Yeah.
But I was just in Japan in June, and, seeing these cars in their proper context, even things like that, they just make more sense. Mm-hmm. And there are certain cars that I find to be really unfortunate looking that are offered in this market, and you just kind of go, well, but then you see it over there, and you're like, kind of makes sense.
Did you get any sense of the decline in auto sales that has hit Japan in a rather significant way?
You know, in truth, I was on vacation largely, so I didn't really, you know, crack open the local paper there to see if there's a lot of reporting about that. But, I mean, I didn't see a lot of activity at what little dealerships you would find. I mean, their footprint of dealerships in Japan is tiny to begin with. Mm-hmm. They have very little inventory. So it's hard to get a sense. You don't see, like, lots of people walking, you know, around a big lot.
Japan's still a big market, though. But
it's a big market, but I mean, you look at their numbers. I mean, they're just
declining.
It's just declining.
And also, a lot of the market is the modern versions of cars like that, which, you know, this one's great fun, but, you know, as a profit making exercise, it's not so great. The little, what do they call them? I can't remember.
But key cars.
Key cars. Thank you.
This is actually not a Kia. It's bigger than that, the 600cc limited, limited.
Yeah.
Footprint.
So that market, I mean, you know. That market's not as important as it used to be, obviously.
Right. Yeah,
that's right. And I love going back to your car here, Chris, the license plate. Kapow is what you've got. Yeah, so that's a vanity plate.
It is a vanity plate. And, you know, I debated doing that at all. But we also thought about just putting Kung on there, like Kung Pow. we thought we'd have a little fun with it.
Why not?
One interesting thing, actually, I just bought a CRX SI a few weeks ago. And it's an 88, and I'm putting it on historic plates. And I knew that it was cheaper, but I didn't realize how much cheaper it is, because it was like $120 to register the car and get plates on it. And the registration,
there's your car.
Yeah,
there you go.
$120, and the plate's good for 10 years, and your insurance goes down.
I was going to say, I bring up the insurance part because that helps.
Yeah.
But you also sort of commit. You're only going to drive a limited number of miles a year,
right.
And that's why you get the insurance.
Right, correct. I mean, it's designed, you know, if you're going to go to a car show or something like that, you're not driving it as a daily driver.
There's just something really hard about the idea of cars of the late 80s now being historical classics you're going to take to the Woodward Dream Cruise. Okay, you know, show up in your Cutlass Supreme. I don't know. We'll see. I'm a little skeptical about
Were you
that's
in town
work.
For the Dream Cruise?
I was not. I was actually in North Carolina. I got back the day afterwards, and we did take that on Woodward just to kind of see the remnants, but it was pretty much already dead. I took it to the Dream Cruise last year when we first got the car, and it was a sensation. I mean, I don't mind telling you, I've never driven a car that's gotten more attention than that.
Wow. Drive everything.
I'm fortunate enough to drive a lot of things, yes.
Yeah.
And I took that to a Cars and Coffee with my girlfriend when we first got it. And I drove a Rolls-Royce convertible that was copper-colored, and she drove that. And this got way more attention than that car did. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah. No, that's great.
Well, look, why don't we take a quick commercial break right now? We got a lot of things to talk about of what's going on in the industry. So we'll give a shout-out to our good friends at Hyundai. Okay, we're back with Chris Pockert and Joe White, Gary and me. We've already got a question from a viewer. Lex wants to know, is it true that Honda is working on a new 5-passenger CUV SUV, rumored to be a downsized version of the full-size Honda Pilot?
That's my understanding as well. Haven't seen the vehicle, but it's rumored to be built alongside the Pilot, so it's a good bet that it's heavily derived from that. I think what they're going for is probably the niche that's in between the CRV and the Pilot for things like that are occupied right now by like a Nissan Murano.
Or Edge.
Yeah, or Ford Edge. Absolutely.
Like that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, makes sense. I mean, look, what's going to happen? You're going to see the crossover / SUV market just segment, because there's, you know, right now the attitude is there's no way you can build enough of them, right?
Right.
And the more you put down, the more market share you're going to have. Of course, that's not really what's going to happen, but I think that's certainly what I see in the product plans that I can look at. It's just proliferations of SUVs and crossovers and sedans just kind of falling away.
If we go back to your earlier point about how the segmentation in Japan, when they were slicing it so very finely, like a Ginsu knife, isn't that perhaps what could happen here with the proliferation of crossovers and SUVs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen it happen before, right? In different segments that get hot and everybody piles in with you know, the sort of the slight variation on the theme, and now you have, you know, 100 entries in a segment that you know, isn't going to grow infinitely. I mean, the question is, can you do it cost efficiently, right? I mean, if you can take a pilot and, you know, sorry, Honda, saw it off and create but do it in an economical way where the there's not a huge amount of additional cost. Sure, fine, why not? But yeah, I mean, I do think that the more entries you get in a segment at some point, and we've seen it all before, it starts to limit, and you know, some of those entries aren't going to be worth it. And
by 2020, the CUV segment will be saturated.
Oh yeah, probably.
I think they'll have good luck with that vehicle, though, because that's already in a somewhat established segment. You have margins that are up there. I mean, you can charge more than a CRV. You can probably charge comparable to Pilot MSRPs for that, you know, versus something where it's an entry-level, you know, $25,000, $30,000 vehicle. You just don't have the margins. And yes, I mean, we've already seen people take cracks at things. Honda is generally a little more conservative, I think, than some other automakers. At times about expanding their portfolio that way.
No, they went off, you know, the nut. They had the Element.
Yeah.
They had the Insight. They had on the Acura side, was it the ZLX?
ZDX.
ZDX.
That was out there for sure.
That was out there.
The Accord Cross Tour.
Yeah.
That probably shouldn't have been as weird of a car as it was. I think the problem was it was hideous looking. And B, it didn't actually have that much space inside because of the intrusion of the shock towers in the back. But that car could have sold if they had done it correctly. It wasn't crazy. They didn't produce a Murano Cross Cabriolet.
The Cross Tour.
The Cross Tour. Yeah. But, I mean, they're you know, like the Murano Cross Cabriolet. I mean, that's definitely a niche car, right?
Well, I would say so.
Yeah.
You know, when you see cabriolets in crossovers, then you know you've reached the outer limits. You're beyond the wall.
That's right. Well, Gary, you always have a list of topics that we should get into. What you got?
I thought it was sort of interesting that we haven't talked about EVs for like 15, 20 minutes. seems like we talk about it all the time. But I thought it was interesting that there seems to be this proliferation of auto companies making announcements of joining up with a Chinese company. So we had the Renault-Nissan Alliance announcing that they're going to be working with Dongfeng in building the EGT, you know, an electric vehicle for the China market. And I mean, so Joe,
there's a million reasons for this to go on, but I think there's probably one very important one, and it goes to a number, 8%. In theory, in 2018 or 2019, depending on what the Chinese government decides, and I've heard both dates, automakers are supposed to build or sell the equivalent of 8% of their volume in China, as electric or plug-in hybrid vehicles. And there's complicated credit schemes and whatnot, but the bottom line, 8%. Well, that is way north of where anybody is right now, obviously. And I think it's also clear the Chinese government is not necessarily going to give the industry a pass on this. They're going to insist that this happen. And so, yeah, absolutely. You're seeing deals like the Nissan one. I think you're seeing Ford buying this company, Zotye, which, as near as I can tell, builds one of these super cheap, although apparently they're the leading brand of electric vehicles in China, but they're building these super cheap electric vehicles, which we don't see here in the United States. Exactly, like the polar opposite of a Tesla. And I think you're going to see this happening more and more as the established global OEMs look at this threat to their Chinese business, which in almost every case is a huge part of their business, and conclude, okay, this isn't going to go away. This regulatory demand is not going to go away. What are we going to do?
And on top of that, too, besides the 8%, there's a stick that says if you don't get it, there's all these fines that you're going to have to pay unless you've got credits.
Right.
And I think Nissan and Ford said, hey, these guys got a pile of credits.
Right.
Let's buy them.
So I wish that, there's a lot of things I wish that I had done. Studied computer science in college.
Learn Chinese
and start a Chinese cheapo electric car company, because now I would just be sitting there waiting for the phone to ring and from some, you know, big OEM, Western OEM, saying, oh, gosh, I need credits. But I think you're going to see this. Look, and there's a less intense but no less important version of this going to play out and will play out in California and in the other states that are following California's lead on zero emission vehicles. I mean, you're either going to have to come up with some sort of electric vehicle or to comply, or you're not going to be able to sell Suburbans and Navigators anymore. So what do you think they're going to do?
So do you think this has implications for the U.S. domestic OEMs in terms of what will happen to them in California? Meaning that isn't there the possibility that the EGT mm-hmm. could come, you know, because they're going to have capacity, right? Oh. So they're going to be building a bunch of these things and say, hey, we've got the technology, let's sell it over there.
So I honestly don't know if bringing a car, that type of car from China to the United States is viable. I mean, those cars apparently are, you know, they're sort of like the electric version yeah. of that, except less
smaller.
That said, I mean, it wouldn't shock me to be told at some point that Ford, you know, let's just say Ford and Zotye, that Ford's engineers go to Zotye and say, that's how you did that? That's how you did that at that level of cost? We can do that. You know, so I would assume, in fact, I'm pretty confident that that's one of the motivations Ford had in doing that deal, is to sort of get a look at how these companies are achieving these cars at the cost levels that they appear to be hitting. And maybe they don't just bring the car, but certainly the knowledge is probably of value. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I looked it up, and I think it's pronounced Zotye or something like that.
Yeah,
Mike
sure
Dunn sent out
yeah,
an email,
yeah.
and he had the pronunciation in there. It was something like that. But in any case, these cars will not meet U.S. crash safety standards at all, so they'd have to be considerably beefed up. But Ford's got the know-how of how to do that.
Yeah, so. Absolutely, they do. And at the same time, if the Chinese company has a way managing the electric vehicle or producing the battery that shaves cost off of that, why wouldn't Ford want to know about that? So
yeah. And looking a little bit further downfield with the growth of the autonomous business and ride sharing, an inexpensive, you know, urban pod where people don't necessarily care about the interior qualities as much. It's just, can I crank them out? Are they cheap enough? And is the revenue stream the vehicle building and selling itself, or is it the service? That could make things like this more viable.
Sure it could. Hey, the control room tells me we got a phone call coming in. Let's bring that in here.
Hi, John, Gary, and guests. This is Dale Leonard out of Cleveland, Ohio. You know, recently there's been this big rah-rah-rah about Buick bringing in a station wagon. All this talk about station wagons, and Ford has had the Flex for several years, and you do not see one piece of advertising. And I've brought this up before, and I've called in before, and I would just like, you know, everybody's comments as to why this car is like non-existent. Great show. Love it. Have a wonderful day. Take care.
Great. Thanks for the call. Who wants to tackle that first?
Well, as a fellow Clevelander, I probably should sit on that. Yeah, the vehicle I believe you're referring to is the Regal-based wagon. And that is sort of a semi-crossovery sort of thing because they've jacked it up a little bit and they put the cladding on it, sort of like an Audi Allroad Volvo XC. So there's proven cases where that can work with a higher-end automaker that maybe has better margins up there. I don't expect for that to be a huge volume model. I do think it's very interesting because it basically provides the virtues of those vehicles, including massive size. There is a huge cargo area in that vehicle, and it does it at a lower price. So I think it's interesting. I think most auto journalists really like the Flex. I mean, it's a neat package. I suspect that the styling of that vehicle is not for everyone. And
clearly not.
Yeah.
And sales numbers.
Yep. Yeah, well, and frankly, that vehicle is at this point just this shy of ancient and hasn't received a ton of updates.
That's a great point. It possibly is the oldest vehicle.
It's a very old vehicle.
On the road.
No, it's a very old vehicle. I mean, the other thing, when I saw the Regal wagon, and you're right, I mean, auto journalists actually form the sort of the biggest cheerleading group for station wagons, car-based station wagons that exists.
I own one.
Right. But the other thing I would say, when I saw the Buick, one of the words that popped into my head was Subaru. You know, Subaru does pretty well with a wagon. They're probably the only people who do well with a wagon. You know, they've taken a lot of share from a nice, very upper, I think, upper income educated demographic. So perhaps that was another thing knocking around in the minds of the Buick product planning group when they were looking at that car.
Well, basically, so that's the Regal Sportback, and it exists in Europe, and so it's very easy to say.
It's easy to bring across.
Let's just bring this across because we're going to bring in the other version of the Regal anyway.
Right. The Sportback's actually the five-door, the hatchback. We're talking about the Tour X.
Tour X. That's right. You're right.
Not Tour Cross, Tour X. But they're able to do both, and maybe they'll carve out a business between two models, because the Regal itself, the previous generation car, hasn't been selling particularly well. I always thought it was a little overpriced, even after the price correction. So
this has been a pet project of Mark Royce. Royce was talking about bringing in a wagon 4 years ago. And part of it is to give Buick something that nobody else has, or almost nobody else has in the market. Create something, again, very distinctive for the brand, maybe more upscale.
And more European.
And more European, definitely. And you're right. They're not going to sell a lot of these things. But maybe it helps the brand in other ways.
Okay, but then it goes to the point of the question of the Flex. So I see that last year, so I checked the number, that they sold fewer than 23,000 Flexes all 2016, which is not particularly good.
No, but the tooling costs of that, you know, those were amortized long ago.
Right, but they never sold a whole lot of Flex.
No,
that's true, but they always said that we sold a disproportionate amount of them in California. So it's sort of a weird image car. Maybe people look at it like a surf wagon or something like that. And so they were reaching customers that maybe Ford otherwise wouldn't normally reach, and that was a desirable outcome for them.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but I think that when they were making the noise about selling a disproportionate number in California, that was because they were selling such an infinitesimal number of anything else in California besides Mustang convertibles to rental lots.
In the Central Valley.
That basically comes down to it.
Central Valley,
And here's a fun fact. So the Flex was designed by a friend of mine, Rich Gressens, who left Ford and went to work for
Whirlpool.
Whirlpool.
I remember that. In fact, he was fired 2 weeks after the thing launched.
That was when the company was downsizing, and they had to get rid of somebody out of design staff, and Rich was, you know, it was the last in, first out. So
congratulations, I'm sorry, right?
Yeah.
Jim Farley, when he was still running marketing in the U.S. market, loved the Flex, and to your point, he said, look, we sell so many of these in California to people who would never otherwise walk into a Ford store, and if you look at it, there's no big blue oval on that.
No.
And the points that he made is, when you ask people, what do you drive, who own a Flex, they don't tell you, I drive a Ford, I drive a Flex. They don't even associate the Flex with the Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's an old design now.
I think people who have them like them a lot. They have certainly not of late made a big point of promoting it, to my knowledge. It's just sort of, there it is, it's out there.
Yeah.
Well, the styling is really unusual. I tend to like things that are bizarre, as you can plainly see. But it's, you know, it's sort of an automotive platypus. Is it a station wagon? Is it a crossover? Is it an SUV? And those things, they're in that muddy middle ground, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't.
You know, sort of interesting is if you look at the design of the Flex, then you look at an Explorer, and you sort of squint.
Not too different, right?
But the Explorer is taller.
Yeah,
and I think that's the thing. I mean, the height kind of goes to people's lizard brain of like I'm up high, I'm protected, I can do battle with the semis, and that doesn't quite do that. It does something else, and there you go.
See, it'd be interesting to know whether the Buick Tour X is higher than a Flex.
That's a good question.
Because if it's not, I mean, it could be. You know, it could be the Dodge Magnum all over again. We all love it, and no one buys it.
Yeah, the Magnum was sat really low.
Right.
I mean, that almost had a hot rod.
But that was pre the craziness.
Yeah. And nobody could see out of a Magnum either, because it had the gun slit windows.
It didn't matter.
But I don't think it sits as high as the Flex does, because the roof line, the greenhouse, is definitely not as tall. So I would be surprised if the overall, the H point is any higher. It's got to be lower.
So the question is Honda smarter going back to the reduced size Pilot because it sits up high than Buick is bringing in a lower?
I think Honda, I mean, again, I haven't seen this vehicle, but if it's basically a five-seat Pilot, I think they'll do just great with it. because that's the type of people, a vehicle that people in this country are buying right now.
Right.
You know, and maybe, you know, if gas goes back up to $3.75 a gallon, maybe that'll change. But I think that's the type of people, vehicle people are buying. And you know, the mass market has made a just profound swing to that formula of, you know, high seating position, wagon back, crossover SUV. That's it.
That's the package.
Sell it all day long. And, oh, by the way, guess what other big market likes that exact same package? China. You know, in China, and I was there for the Shanghai show, just, you know, in China, you know, the party elites may want electric cars, but the masses want SUVs, and that's what they're buying. So it's an interesting tension.
Yeah. Hey, look, we got to take another quick break right now. We're going to come out of that and pay a visit to Dr. Data, but right now we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back with Chris Pocher, Joe White, and now, Dr. Data.
All right, so before we do this one, so last week, as you may recall, we were talking about Strategic Oil Reserve, which nobody ever talks about, right?
Except on this show.
And while I was driving to the studio today, what did I hear on the radio, Joe?
You heard something about the Strategic Oil Reserve. And it's a darn shame that it's apparently not the Strategic Gasoline or Diesel Reserve, because that's the real problem. Well, go ahead, but that's the real problem. It's not so much that we don't have oil in this country, it's that there's all of a sudden there's no place to refine it, or not enough places to refine it. And that could be a spot of bother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just to indicate to people, we're very topical on the show, perhaps even more than we know. All right, so this one, this will be an easy one, I think, because we alluded to this subject earlier in the show. So, Carmen, could you please bring up the first number? Okay, so 55% of these people who were surveyed in the United States and Germany, so this is both Germans and Americans, say no to this.
Oh, I know the answer.
All right,
I'm not going to say.
So, Chris, what do you think it is? So what did they say no?
Or nine.
I haven't the foggiest idea.
All right, that's a good answer.
I'll try electric cars.
Electric cars.
They want nothing to do with electric cars
because these are in the United States and Germany, not in China.
Okay. Well,
all right, John, so give it away.
So I got to believe this is people who do not want autonomous cars.
And you are correct. So Carmen, bring up the answer.
Better.
So they will not drive in a self-driving car. This is Gartner Consumer Trends. Our old friend Mike Ramsey had something to do with this. But, you know, the thing that sort of strikes me is that how do you know you don't want to do something that you've never done?
Exactly.
I mean, I've never skydived. I probably wouldn't say no to that, but still.
No, I agree with that. But I also think that these numbers are an interesting caution, that the sort of the amount of hype that autonomous vehicles have received in venture capital circles and in the media, guilty as charged. You know, you need to kind of remember that ultimately consumers have to be brought along, and which is why I'll just say that I am not convinced that autonomous vehicles are a consumer product for quite a while. Business-to-business product, you know, robo-taxis, delivery, and you see car companies starting to talk about them in those terms. And but yeah, as a consumer product, that kind of stuff is a bit of a caution. You have to sort of wonder how they're going to be brought along.
But would you get? I mean, so it seems to me that these people wouldn't go into a robo-taxi. So, you know, your business case begins to be constrained somewhat by, you know, more than half of your potential customers not being interested in that.
I think it's a lack of familiarity. And if you see your neighbors are riding their robo-taxi, you know, with no trouble, they're able to go to the bar and have a drink in a country where you can drink almost no alcohol and get into a car and drive it, or that they've recovered lost time, that, you know, they've got billable hours while they're in the back seat, you know, they're typing out emails or what have you. It's really about familiarization. Mm-hmm. Most people wouldn't consider an upstart car company, just a normal car, unless they have some, you know, understanding of what that vehicle is. And they usually get that from their neighbor when their neighbor buys it and sees that, oh, it's reliable, it's really comfortable inside, it fits their life well. Well, maybe I'll give that a shot. This is, you know, the idea of a driverless car right now is still sort of pie in the sky. I mean, we're talking about it a lot in the media. But the average consumer, you know, they haven't even figured out that their cars have, you know, lane departure warning systems in there yet. They're not comfortable with it, or they shut it off. We're a long way from understanding that. And it's going to be through things like ride sharing or right. through, you know, commercial vehicles, even semi-trucks or whatever, where people get comfortable with the idea of those vehicles operating safely next to them. Or maybe, you know, they take a flyer and they take a, you know, a Lyft home that's autonomously driven. And then, oh, you know what, I can go... You know, I can go on vacation a lot more because I don't have to worry about the 10 hours of drive time to the beach because I can watch a movie or I can work and it's not a problem.
Well, and there's two things. One is cost, right? I mean, because certainly the first autonomous vehicles are very likely going to be quite expensive and not really something that most affluent people can afford. And so you'll experience them in some service that's provided by a company that owns the car. That's one belief I have. The second belief I have is that, and this that poll kind of reflects this, is that for 100 plus years, automobiles have been marketed as, you know, something that you can master, and that it confers a certain mastery and kind of control that you have, right? I can go anywhere I want. I can drive all night. I am in charge. And that's been all the marketing of this industry for the last 100, as long as there's been automotive marketing, that's what it's been about. And, okay, so this is entirely different. And I mean, I just wrote a little thing yesterday about an autonomous system that Magna is demoing in Berlin today, right? And one of the things I thought was interesting was that they were sort of saying, well, this, you can sort of turn this on, the autonomous function on and off the way you would cruise control. I was like, interesting. They're saying, you're still in control. Only you can decide when you're running autonomously. So I think that part of it, that psychological part of it, is something that the industry or the Apple and Google, for that matter, are going to have to figure out as they go along.
Well, you know, speaking to sort of both of the points that you guys have made. So, John, remember when we had the Domino's DXP vehicle in the studio?
I do.
And that was the little Chevy Spark with the oven?
Yeah.
So this week we saw Domino's and Ford get together on an autonomous vehicle announcement.
Yeah, deliver pizzas to your home with an autonomous car. Of course, they're going to black out the windows because there's actually going to be a Ford engineer behind the steering wheel, and they don't want you to see that. They want to create the grand illusion. The engineer will not be driving the car, so they say. It's going to be full autonomy. But this gets to what we're talking about. Here's one way that you start to familiarize the public with an autonomous car. I mean, Christ, it's all about delivering pizza, you know? And so Ford got literally global headlines out of it. But, you know, continuing or going back to a little bit of the conversation before, if you go back 110 years ago and you ask people, are you going to give up your car and get in one of those horseless carriages? And they're going to say, those horseless carriages that shoot out sparks and backfire and they'll break your arm
right,
when you
break
try to
your
crank
arm
them?
When, yeah, right.
Hell no, I'm not getting
right.
in one of those
right.
things.
Right.
Well, and,
right.
and remember that if it's the most expensive vehicles where the cost of autonomous hardware can be absorbed, those are the aspirational vehicles, right? The six-figure cars or the Teslas of the world, the Audis, the Lamborghinis, or probably won't be Lamborghini. But if you've got, people lusting after these expensive cars and they become cool like Tesla has, people may be more interested in that technology than you
yeah.
think.
And the legal framework will or in policy regulatory framework will make a big difference. I mean, I remember a conversation I had with someone in the industry, this is years ago now, and this topic was first just kind of bubbling up. And I think you alluded, Chris, earlier to this. I mean, you know, so can I go to a restaurant or a bar and have, you know, maybe three glasses of wine, and safely, legally, without violating any law, be taken home by my autonomous car? Until the answer to that question is yes, I might be a tough sell. The minute the answer to that question is yes, now a lot of people are like, okay, sign me up. I can, you know, I can go out in the town, and it's legal, and I'm safe, and everybody around me is safe. Perfect.
But, you know, Chris, to your point about this becoming desirable because it's a six-figure car. I mean, it seems to me that, like the Magna thing you were talking about, is all of the suppliers are working to bring the cost down so this becomes not a purview of the very wealthy. It becomes more democratized, that this becomes technology almost instantaneously that is affordable on, I don't know, POW cars. I mean, it's
well, there are some companies, like, you know, look at Google. They abandoned the sort of gumdrop koala cars, but their idea was at that low end of the market, right? Mm-hmm. So there's different approaches to it, and obviously scale is going to be key for getting the cost down of all the hardware. There's a lot of computing power that's needed. There's a lot of data pipe that's needed, you know, bandwidth to relay information from the infrastructure and from other vehicles. All that costs money. But, you know, there's already been talk of LiDAR sensors being $50. And, right. You know, just a few years ago, there were these, you know, huge spinning appendages that cost thousands and thousands of dollars. So they're making real progress.
Hmm. They are. And remember, too, there's going to be a cost offset because the data is what everybody's really after.
Well, but that's the problem, of course, is cost offset for whom?
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem right now is that, you know, like, who gets that data to sell? You know,
right.
Do I get it as the owner of the vehicle?
Hell no.
Well, right. Does General Motors get it? Does Google get it? Right.
Yeah, so, they're going to get it.
Right, right.
But it's going to be the razor blade and the razor, right? Hey, take this car.
Well, I mean, we're all very comfortable with the transaction that goes with these things,
with
right? So, I mean, it's just a matter of kind of getting the business model. Well, not just, but it's partly a matter. Chris, the infrastructure things you talked about, I mean, you know, goodness gracious, you can't complete a cell call in, you know, sometimes in downtown Detroit. And so now we're going to put 3 million autonomous vehicles, you know, shooting data back and forth to the mobile cloud. That's just going to be a little while before this
sure.
all kind of happens.
But remember, it also doesn't necessarily have to go directly to the cloud. It can go vehicle to vehicle, you know, shortwave, and then up to the cloud.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we'll see how it goes. One other interesting thing about the data, going back to that line of thinking, I recently was in Germany to take a look at an Audi autonomous cabin concept. And one of the things they were talking about is that they look at the future of luxury vehicles as being a filter for all the extraneous noise from all the advertising that's going to be bombarded into these smart autonomous vehicles. So that's the luxury. The luxury is that you don't have to sit through the blinking light that says Whoppers 2 for $5 as you drive by. That's an interesting, you know, potential reality too.
Yeah, it's kind of a hellscape, right? If you can only afford a $25,000 car, you're going to have to sit through all kinds of annoying ads. But if you can afford a $70,000 car, you can ride in splendor.
Well, but I mean, it's like if you go buy an Amazon Kindle right now, there's one price with the Kindle with ads and a much higher price for the Kindle without ads. So I mean, the same thing will apply to cars. But you know, the thing I wonder about is that if you told someone 10 years ago, would you just get, if somebody just drove up to your house or to your workplace and said, come on in and I'll give you a ride home or to work, would you get in that person's car? That's crazy.
Are they offering you candy? I mean, that sounds a little...
But the thing right. is that so right. so people are doing this, you know, millions of times a day with Lyft and Uber and right. whatever, you know, I mean, and it's just like, it's normal. Mm-hmm. It, you know, I mean, and so think about it. I mean, you'd say, well, let's see, if a yellow cab comes, it's got legitimacy.
Right.
But if some guy rolls up in, you know, a whatever.
Nissan Altima.
Yeah.
Very often.
Well, and it's normal for certain parts of the population that are located in certain parts of the country, meaning, you know, big cities. If you go into a lot of the middle of the country, they've probably never seen an Uber. They've never downloaded the app. They don't know what it is other than from, you know, hearing about it in the news.
Well, right. and that's right. I mean, again, I mean, I think autonomous vehicle, all of this kind of mobility, autonomy, electrification, I think is more an urban phenomenon, is going to be more of an urban phenomenon than a suburban rural phenomenon. And you know, this is a big country, and there's a lot of rural and suburban. So you could have a very bifurcated technology market, right? I mean, you could have, you know, San Francisco is 100% autonomous electric cars. You come out here to Detroit, and we're still in, you know, F-150s and Raptors, and it's just a different world.
I think that's true to a point. I think you'll see things mushroom out of the cities, but I do think that you'll see autonomy play a role in normal suburbs, maybe not in the far reaches of the exurbs or out in the country. But again, the reality is people think that everybody's moving to cities right now. If you look at all the statistics, everybody's moving to cities. Well, if you have an autonomous car, that commute's no longer really an issue. It's lost time.
Yeah. In fact, so it could create. Because we just got two comments from viewers. Quang says, I would invest in an autonomous vehicle provided the price is right. My 1 hour commute will allow me to sleep an extra 2 hours a day. And then middle wrote in to say, it's just a matter of time before delivery jobs go the way of the dodo.
Yeah, and I think both of those commenters have really good points. I think automating certain types of delivery could absolutely be a threat to the conventional definition of a delivery driver.
Mm-hmm. And Brian Young wants to know, how will autonomous technology impact vehicles and brands that are opposite to autonomy? Performance vehicles, Jeep off-roaders, and the like.
That's really going to be a tough nut to crack. So you've seen companies like Mazda that where driving matters, and they want to get the steering feel right, and they want to get the throttle, just so. It's that stuff ceases to matter if you have fully autonomous vehicles. And as long as it's still legal to drive your own car, there will be a niche market of people that absolutely, from my cold, dead hands, they want to drive their own car. I tend to be, one of those people a lot of the time. But it's going to be a smaller market, and it could drive the cost of those vehicles up. It could weed out a lot of players. I think it'll be really interesting to see how well that works. I don't think it'll be available for everybody. And I think the reality of autonomous cars is one of two things will happen. If the humans are the ones causing all the accidents, and we're talking pretty far down the road, when it's the majority of new vehicles produced are autonomous. You're going to find out that the government is reluctant to let people drive on their own because they are causing the problems and they're the wild card in the system. Or in the shorter term, insurance is just going to be, hugely expensive and price people out of
the
driving
insurance
their own
companies. So the insurance companies will absolutely play a very large role and maybe not a predictable role in the adoption and deployment of this technology. But one thing that bugs me about this whole discussion is we have autonomous technology, which is thousands of dollars a car, maybe even tens of thousands, but certainly thousands of dollars a car. And the automakers are all running around saying, oh, we're on it. We're going to do this stuff by 2021, 2020, whatever. But a number of companies are slow walking, putting automatic emergency braking into cars, which is, $300 or $400 or $500 a car, maybe less, and certainly less if you get scale. It's a completely understood and knowable technology. And you've got a fair number of car companies that are not rushing to make that standard across the board. I mean, some have, but others are not. So I have to say, I look at that and I say, okay, really? How much autonomy are we really going to get until there's either a regulatory push, which I think you're alluding to, or a decisive consumer push, something that, oh my gosh, if we don't have that, we're just toast. We'll see what happens.
So Chris, you're talking about when the majority of vehicles are autonomous vehicles. I mean, how far out do you see that?
I think it's quite far out. And we're, right now Ford is talking about 2021, they'll be marketing a, fully autonomous car. And I think that'll be under a very specific set of circumstances. It may not even be for purchase. It may be in a geo-fenced area, in a city or, running fixed routes or something like that. And a lot of data needs to be collected, as you were pointing out. There's variances, legislatively that have to be figured out. Audi has... The new A8 is capable of level 3 autonomy, meaning on the freeway, it can drive up to speeds of 31 miles an hour all on its own, as long as it's on a divided freeway. And they take legal responsibility for the car.
A freeway can drive 31 miles an hour?
Well, in bumper-to-bumper traffic. You could get into the back of the car, and as long as traffic doesn't, that's the level of autonomy. It's not the systems that beep after 10 seconds and say, put your hands back on the wheel. It doesn't do that at all. And Audi takes responsibility. But even that vehicle is not legal in the U.S. yet. They're working on that right now. They may be able to get it done by the time the vehicle is supposed to launch, but even that's up in the air.
Of course, none of that ever bothered Tesla. Hey, look, we got to take a quick break right now. We're going to come back. We got lots to talk about. We got some more questions from our viewers. But first, a shout out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back talking about all kinds of things, cars. Here's, I think, a great way to kick us into another segment. Joe Laszlo wrote in to say, all the new cars that are going to get totaled in Texas, if they're new electrics, who gets the $7,500 tax credit?
Well, I guess the people who buy them, right? I mean, they're still... Well,
oh, no, if they're totaled.
Oh, if they're totaled.
No, they're underwater, you know? I guess nobody gets
them. So, in other words...
They were never...
Oh,
they were never sold.
Okay, but, yeah, they never sold them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And usually...
That's a good question, though.
It is.
I mean, how would that be handled?
I don't know. And usually when you buy the car... the tax credit price is factored in, right, into the purchase price. Like they basically lop it off the top
goes
and,
to the,
and the automaker.
It goes to the buyer.
Well, yeah, but doesn't the automaker take the price off?
Well, right, no, right.
Well,
right,
yeah, for promotional purposes, they say, you know, with the $7,500. But remember, it's a tax credit.
You have to go
You've
get it.
Got to have $7,500 worth off
yeah,
or it's not worth doing.
Yeah, so I guess the bottom line is if it's a $40,000 electric car and it was going to be marketed at, you know, with the credit, the car company is going to, you know, or the insurance, probably more like the insurance, or for the, actually it's owned by the dealer if it's sitting at the dealer a lot, right? So anyway, somebody, either the finance company or the insurance company is gonna eat that and write it off, and hopefully more vehicles of every kind will be sold, which is exactly, so today, and this is what I was busy doing today, or working on this today with my colleagues. Today seems to be the day when, you know, not only the sun was shining, you know, in the sky.
In Texas,
I think, but certainly not raining, but also the sun is starting to shine on the auto business down there because it's, you know, car dealerships are coming back online, back in business, and they're starting to realize, oh, we're going to sell a lot of vehicles down here. You know,
because so many personal vehicles were ruined by the flood.
To paraphrase Wavy Gravy, there's always a little bit of heaven in a disaster area.
I don't expect a Wavy Gravy quote.
As serious as and tragic as a lot of what's gone on down in Texas is, the fact is that people are going to need to rebuild their lives, and that's going to be great for car dealers and that, you know, the ones that have survived, and I think most of them will. And it's going to be great for the car business, the industry, because perhaps you've been talking about this. There's been a little bit of an inventory issue in the industry. Well, this will definitely help resolve some of that because there's a big demand for vehicles, replacement vehicles, on the way in Houston, I think.
Yeah, so that area accounts for 4.3% of all retail sales so far this year. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So, first off, there's going to be a huge drop, you know, because to your point, Joe, people are trying to get their lives together. They're trying to hopefully
this
get back to their houses.
Yeah, this past week and going forward for the next several days, I think that's right. I mean, I'm assuming that there will be, August sales were forecasted as kind of meh anyway. They'll probably be even worse than that. I expect to hear a lot about storm effect on sales tomorrow on Friday. But going forward, and this has been true in other, you know, Katrina and Sandy, I think in particular, a month or two after the event, when the insurance checks come and people are able to get their acts and their lives together, things kind of bounce back.
That's absolutely true. Probably going to happen this time.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's as you said, it's a huge market. Probably a lot of trucks will get sold. Not just because they're replacing trucks, but because people who are going to be rebuilding that community will need trucks to do that work. So that's also a good thing for the Detroit 3.
Will be. Gary, what else you got on your list?
I was going to say, speaking of trucks, so large pickups totaled 15% of the U.S. sales between August 2016 and 2017, the Houston area. So, I mean, that
16%
for
Houston area?
15% of U.S. sales in the Houston area.
It's a significant
market. Yeah, it's a huge market for trucks.
All trucks, Toyota.
It's important. Very important. Those poor people that have suffered through this, I think the last, you know, I saw those reports today about the car dealerships opening up, and I'm thinking, you know, you got 3 feet of water in your house. I mean, I think the last thing you're thinking about is...
I did, but I didn't mean to make light of it. But once the water recedes and you're just like, okay, well, how do I get my life back together? How do I get to work? I've got to have a car.
Right.
And I think, you know, AutoNation said this today. They're going to truck 500 to 1,000 used vehicles that they have in their national network and truck them down there and have a big sale middle of next month. Their competitors undoubtedly do the same thing. And so I think you're going to see a real effort by the industry to, you know, do well by doing good. People need the transportation, and they happen to have a lot of cars they need to get rid of, so there you go.
Speaking of electric cars, and speaking, we mentioned Tesla briefly. I saw that they reduced prices of their very high-end cars by 3% because they thought that the efficiencies they're getting out of their battery factory is allowing them to do that. But I don't want to talk about the Model S's and the Model X's. So did you guys see that Cummins this week announced a Class 7 semi-truck electric vehicle? Now, are they trying to steal the thunder from Tesla, or are they serious about this? Is anybody really going to buy an electric truck from a company that is known as a preeminent diesel engine manufacturer?
I think they probably didn't set out to steal Tesla's thunder. But this vehicle was in development for a fairly long period of time. It's a working vehicle, and it was developed with Roush. And it's a Class 7, you can see it on the screen there, dubbed the Aos. It only has 100 miles of range, which is very little. So it's limited to strictly, you know.
Joe's shaking his head here.
I'll explain why in a second.
It is city deliveries, but they can charge in 1 hour to full capacity. So for, you know, trucking where it's a traditional route from one end to the other or, you know, within the city, that could be viable. Supposedly the Tesla has 200 to 300 miles of range, but it's all, who knows?
It's
all conjecture.
So it's a
well,
truck,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree. I mean, you know, what most people, and certainly people who drive Class 8 trucks, think is a long haul truck is a truck that can go up to 1,000 miles between stops at a truck stop and a fill up. So that's a long way from 200 or 300 miles. But Chris is, I believe, and I agree with Chris that the market for in city one, you know, one day in out, you know, milk truck, you know, type of service and duty cycles, that market is very susceptible to electrification. I really believe that. And again, partly because of regulation. I think you're going to see cities, certainly in California, it's the urban thing again, saying, you know what, we don't want diesel vehicles in our center city. And if they don't do it in the United States, they're going to do it in Europe, and they probably will do it in China. So if you think globally about this, an electric truck, you know, that has 100 or 200, 300 miles of range can do a duty cycle one, you know, of one day. You know, milk runs between factories in Shanghai, right? I think Cummins is undoubtedly serious about it. I believe the other incumbent truck makers are serious about this, have been serious about it. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see a serious effort to market trucks like this, probably fairly soon.
Yeah, of course, we had someone from Toyota in the studio three months ago, fuel cell, that they're testing out in Long Beach right now.
Right, and again, because the CARB, the California Air Resources Board, has told all the trucking companies, you got to clean up your act here.
Yeah.
Because with the ships that are coming in belching out all kinds of diesel exhaust and the diesel trucks belching out exhaust.
I mean, Port of Los Angeles could be really ground zero for this because the Port of Los Angeles has been a long, as I understand it, long ongoing controversy and concern in California about the amount of diesel soot that's put out by the trucks that shuttle from the front to the back of the, you know, in the ship side to, I guess there's a point where the trailers and whatnot are put on long haul trucks and sent out. And that's milk run stuff, right? I mean, it's back and forth and back and forth. And the trucks can go back to a base at the end of the shift and recharge. Well, why wouldn't you want to put that on an electric technology?
But why wouldn't you use hydrogen so you can just refill it diesel?
There isn't any rehydration.
Because there's a grid for electricity right now.
If you have the milk run sort of thing, just like the airport shuttle at Metro where they're, you know, using natural gas.
In Southern California, there is sort of some hydrogen refueling capability. Why not?
But yeah,
I think you'll see the manufacturers will be very aggressively showing that they are serious about the technology, and then the next thing is they'll go to governments around the planet, right, and say if you want this, you need to help us with fill in the blank hydrogen refueling or electric grid infrastructure, recharging infrastructure,
or just tax credits.
Tax credits, all those things,
You know, Volvo was supposed to kick off a program this year, I want to say at the Port of Long Beach, where it was going to have electric an electric truck. I don't think it's plural yet. And it was going to run all around the yards, pure battery power. And then when it got out onto the road, they're going to put in overhead electric lines.
Like
the old trolleys. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now it can run, 50, 60 miles with zero battery power, except for maybe some acceleration and the like, so that you get to the end, you run around that yard, turn around, and zip back again.
But see, then you have to the infrastructure cost
you
of running the lines, right?
Right.
And the other thing, even though this vehicle that they showed only has 100 miles of range, they said they want to get into production by 2019. And I got to be honest with you, I have more faith in a company that's been around 98 years that knows how to do mass production than I do in Nikola or Proterra, companies that are startups that haven't faced a lot of these problems before, producing something that can actually do this. And they also are looking not just at pure electric models, but range extended hybrid models where they leverage their diesel expertise and they use them like a Chevy Volt, as an onboard generator that then they can go 200-400 miles. That doesn't sound too bad to me because you still end up with lower emissions.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, a company like Cummins, you can talk all you want about how a company like that is weighed down by legacy and so on and so forth. Well, one positive legacy they have is that they have customers, who run truck fleets and delivery companies today, and they can go speak to those customers and say, okay, we're going to do this. What do you think? And if we, and actually get an order and have a network to support that. So I think you're right. I mean, if they're forward-looking and aggressive, which seems like they are, I think some of the incumbent truck companies could get around on this. And I think there will be a regulatory framework that'll help them do it.
I think the startups, including Tesla, are going to go, yeah, Cummins, you're validating everything we've been telling the world.
I think that is certainly true. That is certainly true. It is a validation of that.
And I believe Cummins said they don't want to build the vehicle themselves. They don't have any experience building whole vehicles.
Right.
So I don't know if they're planning on doing that with Roush.
So can we start the Cummins Tesla rumor right here?
Mm-hmm. Well, Cummins sells, as you guys know, in the Class 7 and 8, everybody specs out everything, engine, transmission, axles, pretty much, except for Freightliner. So I don't think Freightliner wants to get, or Cummins wants to get in the business of competing with its customers. I think it wants to say, you want a diesel, you want a natural gas engine, you want an electric powertrain, you come to us, we got it for you.
And, and just as when everybody seemed to report that Volvo was going to make all of their cars electric vehicles by 2020 because they didn't realize that they said they were making electrified vehicles, I thought it was interesting that when they launched this truck, they also launched a series of other engines at the same time, and in their press materials it says, Cummins continues to be the leader in clean diesel technology and understands that for many markets, diesel engines will be the best solution for decades to come. So, and then they said, in 2022, we're going to have an all-new diesel engine ready to go. So let's not make too much of their forward-thinkingness
Well, they're hedging their bets. They know they can make money doing that. They know how to do it. They know their customers want it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're
That's
the diesel
they
company.
To do. Yeah.
It's like, Parley's electric motorcycle that we're still waiting for.
Hey, look, we're getting down to the end of the show. We still got a few questions here from some of our viewers. We ought to jump right into this. So I'll just throw this out here. Frank Reed wants to know, if FCA were to put just Jeep up for sale, wouldn't GM and Ford be all over the purchase? I can't imagine they would let Jeep get bought out from underneath them.
Correct.
Yeah.
Next.
Okay, Mark K wants to know, and you're going to have to look this up, Gary. He says, why is Volvo doing so badly? I didn't think Volvo was doing very badly.
I think their sales have softened.
Well, I know the XC90 has taken a nosedive, which shocks me, and we've talked about that on the show a lot. But I thought with the new XC60 coming, I guess maybe safe.
Well, it's coming.
It's coming.
It's not out there yet.
Yeah.
And I think they may have had, from what I understand, a contenting problem with some of their XC90s where they had too many high-spec models with, in particular, a very expensive audio system. Mm. And that's like $3,000-$4,000, and it's just a little too much on top of it.
They hit the limit on that. Yeah.
While you look that up, Gary, A.M. Guerrero wants to know, did Ford do the right thing limiting the new 2018 Fiesta for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa? Is that right? I don't know.
You mean not bringing it to the United States?
Well, it sounds like not Southeast Asia either. I guess I don't know enough about that.
I haven't heard that they've basically stopped production for the U.S.
I have not either.
But I've heard that there's certain, you know, certainly concern that that won't come in the next generation.
Yeah.
Which would make sense if you follow market trends, that they're just not, they're not there. And they're going to bring, they're going to bring the Echo Sport
here.
Yeah. Yeah. To battle the Chevy Trax and all the other cute dudes.
I mean, I agree. I mean, I think the market, the United States market has spoken on the sort of the return of the micro compact car, and it has said no. And it wants, you know, and smaller SUVs is like the ones you mentioned, if anything, will be what you see in that segment, because the companies can charge more for those and try to make a profit.
Right. Okay, last question here or comment. Raffi wants to know, as in the refreshed Sonata, are handling and other improvements held back only to be introduced during the refresh, or are newly discovered improvements, this doesn't make sense. I guess, yeah, do companies hold back improvements until they do a refresh?
Still waiting for that water carburetor.
Yeah.
I do know the answer to this.
Go ahead.
It depends on the company.
Yeah.
So automakers like especially Honda and Toyota, you know, they get, you know, let's say, I don't know the exact time, about 12 months before a job one, they say, freeze the design. Don't change anything. Don't care how much better or cheaper you can make it. Don't change a thing. Why? Because changes introduce variability. Variability leads to quality problems. Hyundai, on the other hand, has had, no, we're just going to improve on the fly. And they've been doing a lot of updates all along. Seems to me, though, that this time around, Hyundai maybe is acting more like Toyota and Honda. I don't know. Maybe you'd have a better sense of that, Gary.
I think that the nature of what he's suggesting is that we'll put out something better that will make people want to buy it because we've not put the technology in there. And I don't think any car maker would do that. I think that...
No, you want to sell right now.
Yeah,
right
because,
now.
Because you're not gonna bet on the if come. You're gonna bet on the sure thing.
Well, the other thing, the questioner raised an interesting point, which something I believe that Tesla has changed the game on this, and which is the concept of constant upgrades,
especially over the air.
Absolutely,
it gets upgraded while it's sitting in the garage.
They upgrade functional, functional stuff,
right.
At least
even the sound system.
Brakes.
Well, brakes. I mean, that's what I mean. Sound system stuff. Every company says, "Oh yeah, we'll upgrade." OnStar or whatever. Yeah, they upgrade. They have the performance and the behavior of the car, and you have a whole show arguing about whether that's a good thing to do. But they do it, and I do think that they've changed people's expectations, so that holding back, I think going forward is going to be a tougher sell.
Yeah. Hey, look, good stuff. Want to thank you guys for being in here. We're going to have to wrap it up. But Chris Pockert, thanks so much, not just for coming along yourself, but for bringing the POW into the studio with you.
Thanks for making all the space that it needs.
Yeah. And it didn't need a whole lot.
It's like a dance floor is around it.
You could put in a few in here.
Yeah. Joe White, always great having you here. So thanks for coming back. And Gary, we'll keep on doing this.
Okay.
And, of course, want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.